Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. You know the drill. We're Zooming on Monday afternoon. We begin our show every single day with some fabulous political limericks. As I always say, Calvin Trillin is to the nation, as Skip Tenzar is to The Attitude. All right, Dave, hit it with the music.
Istanbul was Constantinople. Now it's Istanbul, not Constantinople. Been a long time gone. Constantinople, now it's Turkish delight on a moonlit night.
After a performance worthy of Omar Sharif, he finally gave in and signed COVID relief. Why all the bluster? His brand's lost its luster. The emperor has no clothes, not even a fig leaf.
People just liked it better that way.
So take me back to Constantinople. No, you can't go back to Constantinople. Been a long time gone. Constantinople, why did Constantinople get the work?
As many of you know, one of my favorite places to go to mine for information and get great talkers is theconversation.com. I probably mine it more than probably anyone on the planet. What I love is that it's all over the world. It's in Canada. It's in England. It's a fabulous place where they convince or they encourage professors and PhDs to do something that they don't normally do, which is sort of write these very usable sort of magazine-y type pieces that people like me will say, wow, I didn't know this. And then I get to grab them and interview them on the air. It has turned out to be an incredible blessing in disguise. I saw an article that was entitled something that I really have been thinking a lot about. Can Joe Biden heal the United States? Political experts disagree. So of course, I don't go to the guy that says he can heal it. I go to the guy that says, he can't. The title of his version was America's Political Divide Will Be Very Hard to Heal. Let me welcome to the program Robert Talese. He is a professor of philosophy at Vanderbilt University. What you don't know, Robert, is my brother graduated from Vanderbilt University.
Lots of
stories about that, let me tell you. You really sort of specialize in contemporary political philosophy.
Right.
I read your piece, and nothing in there was unpredictable. But I wanted to share a story with you that was the reason why I wanted to reach out to you. So okay. I've run for governor, run for Congress, been a state rep. Religiously read a magazine called Governing Magazine. It really basically no longer exists, which is a really sad commentary. But many, many years ago, maybe even 25 or 30 years ago, I was reading an editorial at Governing Magazine. And this one line stuck with me. In fact, I've given speeches based on this quote. The editor wrote, "Politics in America could be dumbed down to two sentences." Ready? "Me citizen, him crook." I read that and I'm like, whoa. And then the more I thought about it, I was beginning to realize that this wasn't a political conversation about policy and philosophy. It really was coming down to me citizen, him crook. That was back 25 or 30 years ago. And now I look at the last 10 years and the extreme has gotten worse with each passing year. And it's not even me citizen, him crook. It's that I am now the enemy. I am now to be vanquished, frankly killed in some ways, and maybe not killed physically, but destroyed in every way. And what Donald Trump has done has built on that extreme. I want to welcome you to the program and let's talk about what exists today and the challenges for Joe Biden, because a lot of people saw the empathy and saw the niceness and saw the I'm not going to lie to you and thought, how could people not want to embrace it? And yet Donald Trump got more votes than any candidate ever running for president, except for Joe Biden. I'm thinking I must be on La La Land because couldn't they see the difference? And why wouldn't they want the empathetic person? Why would they want the bombastic you know what? So welcome to the program. Hold my hand and explain to me what we are seeing and how do we survive it?
Yeah, this is the million-dollar question. Is it $1 million now? Anyway, this is the million-dollar question. And so I think that part of the explanation for where we find ourselves as a country has to do with some really wonky political science-y kinds of thoughts about the ways in which partisanship, by which I mean the sort of the two major parties in the U.S., the conservatives and the liberals, the Republicans and the Democrats, where partisanship has over the past 25, 30 years in this country shifted more into a lifestyle than into an agenda of policy proposals and commitments about what government should do, such that as a country, you know, forget about the politicians for a second, let's think about the citizens. Liberal and conservative citizens in the United States, with respect to a large number of really key policy issues, are no more divided now. They're still divided, but they're no more divided now than they were 25 years ago. And in fact, on some crucial issues, or at least issues that were like the one voter issues in the 80s, rank and file Republicans and Democrats have actually moderated and come closer together. The problem in the country is that we dislike each other more and more. And in fact, cross-partisan animosity now far outstrips any actual policy-based division. And in fact, I should say, just one indication of this, negative attitudes towards cross-partisan marriage in this country outstrip negative and disapproving attitudes towards interracial marriage. That is, we're more upset by the thought of our child marrying somebody who's an affiliate of the other party than America is at the thought of even interfaith or interracial marriage.
Where did the seeds, how did we fertilize the dislike? And the reason I ask that is I am the liberal child of an uber conservative family. When you used to go to my dad's door, it said English only. Okay.
Oh,
the only time my mother was proud of me was here. I ran for governor, ran for Congress, first female nominee, got more votes than any Democrat, but still lost, you know. Anyway, was when I was a fellow at Harvard, and you know who came to my class? Rush Limbaugh's producer, Snerdly. And my mother, who of course was listening to Rush Limbaugh, heard Rush Limbaugh say that Snerdly was having some time at the Kremlin on the Charles with Arnie Arneson. That was when my mother was proud of me. Not for running for governor, not for running for Congress, but because my name was mentioned on Rush Limbaugh. And yet I come from that family, so they technically couldn't disown me. And while we disagreed, and sometimes I would be really angry at them, I could still find a way to love them. I'm 67. What I'm trying to figure out is, how did it go from my mother and father to a place right now where we really don't like each other? And I'm thinking, I'm kind of a likable person. What is it about me you've decided was so offensive?
Good. You mentioned an aspect to this that I think is really important and often overlooked. Cross-partisan animosity, dislike for the other guys, used to be primarily aimed at the party leaders, at the candidates, at the politicians. What's changed again in the past 25 years is that now we dislike one another. That is, that partisan animosity has now sort of come home to roost. So now liberals, Democrats, conservatives, and Republicans dislike each other, even as neighbors and citizens who inhabit the same city. Part of the explanation for why animosity has escalated so much, despite the lack of a similar escalation in our actual policy divides, maybe surprisingly has to do with the ways in which we've internalized the tasks of democratic citizenship to such an extent that we have crowded out of social spaces anything that's not an expression of or an articulation of our political identities. More and more of what we do in our everyday lives, and far more of what we do in our everyday lives than 25 years ago, is now understood as a communication of or an expression of our politics. That politics has become inescapable. And what that means is that we spend more and more time with people who are politically just like us. As the country has become more diverse across a range of metrics, the actual social spaces citizens inhabit in their day-to-day lives have become more intensely homogeneous politically. And so we spend more and more time with people just like us. That's natural. That's the kind of creature we are. But because the organizing principle around which we build our social lives has become more centrally our partisan identities, we've come to see the other side as increasingly inscrutable and alien. And politicians, because their job is to win elections, are responding to what's basically just good strategery. You know, feed on that, emphasize the differences, valorize intransigence so that you can mobilize your base. I think that's how this has happened. We've overdone our politics in a way, and therefore have become, perhaps paradoxically, less capable at doing it well.
Something happened the other day. I think I know ways of addressing it, and I'm going to throw them at you. There's a policeman that drives past my house all the time because I live across the street from a little elementary school. And we're always talking, and I'm always charming. And I said, you got to see the Buddha in the backyard. And the other day, he stopped his car and said, I didn't know who you were. And I went, excuse me? He said, I just went back and the guys at the station told me who you were. I said, who am I? He was like frightened all of a sudden, like that he had been so friendly and cordial and normal with someone who was equally friendly and cordial and normal. And I said, it's okay. It's who I am. I didn't wake up in the morning and say, I'm liberal Arnie, the income tax woman. I woke up in the morning and said, I need to vacuum. But it was like, he was so shocked that he liked me. And I was like, depressed that he was shocked that that was possible. So I'm hearing you. And of course, in the pandemic, that's the only way you get to see people, because we're all now even more isolated from right. anything, let alone our peers and our friends. It was a wonderful opportunity for politicians to mine the extremes, because right. we were really living in a bubble. And the bubble was not just the bubble of the pandemic, it was the bubble of our brain. You have your Facebook friends, you have your Netflix movies, you have your social media, and then you don't even have human beings that you can interact right. with. I realized when that cop suddenly was like so shocked, that that really sort of explained what you were sort of talking about. Here's what I think. I have always believed, I joined Air Force ROTC when I was 17. It was the first time they opened up ROTC to women. Right. And the reason why I did it, it turned out that they didn't know what to do with us, so I didn't last. But the reason why I did it was that because of the Vietnam War, and I saw my peers and my male friends go off, get drafted and die, I realized that either all of us go or none of us go. And that we all needed skin in the game. Including me. I was freaking 17.
Right.
Fast forward, I'm 67. I still believe that. And therefore, one of the things you were commenting on about the fact that we are so isolated from each other and the lack of social spaces and nowhere to interact, I think if we are to heal America, we need to create those spaces. We need universal service. We need something that creates a space where you're not in there because of gender. You're not in there because of economic status. You're not in there because you're from New England or you're from California. You're just in there. And if you expect me to be a good citizen, then part of good citizenship is, what do I owe my country?
That seems to me very promising. The idea that there could be a citizen building enterprise of civic service that's not in the service necessarily of partisan aims. That's the really important.
Absolutely.
That's the really important part. Now, note, all of those opportunities for volunteering, I'll tell you a quick story. Giving a public lecture very early in my thinking about this sort of idea that politics has too thoroughly infiltrated our social lives, the audience member asked me, like, what are we supposed to do? I believe you. You've convinced me. I need to do things that aren't just contributing to my partisan objectives. But what kind of thing can I do? And I said, I don't know. Why don't you volunteer to pick up litter from the local park? And the response was, that's a liberal thing to do. It's in our brains, as you put it a moment ago, Arnie, that the very idea that there could be something that we can do together that contributes to the common good in a pro-social way, that's cooperative, and yet not in furtherance of some particular partisan identity or agenda, we've sort of lost the imagination for that. We don't know how to think about activities that aren't already captured by partisan loyalties and affiliation. I think that's detrimental to democracy for roughly the reasons you just spelled out.
I am pro-choice. I used to be an abortion counselor, okay? In fact, my mother wanted me to have an abortion. That's another story. Anyway, I am a big supporter of the Salvation Army, and they are not pro-choice. In fact, they're very much anti-choice.
That's right.
But someone said, why? I said, because when there's a fire, They don't ask whether you're pro-choice. They're there with blankets, and they're there with pillows and food. When you leave jail and you get the $50, you go to the Salvation Army, and they don't ask you what you were in for. They figure out how to clothe you. I said, I can't deny the good because we disagree on something. What has been amazing is, I'll never forget, there was a robbery at the Salvation Army many, many years ago when I first moved to Hopkinton, New Hampshire. And I heard about it. I went down to the Salvation Army, the thrift store, and I gave them $50. And they said, why? To make up for what they stole. The word went out throughout the Salvation Army, what Arnie, the liberal pro-choice politician, had done. But that wasn't the person who did it. The person who did it was the person who goes to the Salvation Army because that's where she buys her wedding dress. And that's where she bought the dress when she went to see Bill Clinton at the inaugural. That was the Arnie. That's where I know my friends were shocked when they heard that I go to the Salvation Army. And I looked at them and I said, why don't you?
That seems right. One of the byproducts of the extent to which our lives have been sort of colonized by partisanship is that we've become less able to recognize nuance and ambiguity and vagueness in our political commitments of the kind that you've just described. We're so, again, and this benefits politicians and campaign managers more than the country, right? But we're so committed to the idea that our allies have to be allies, they have to check every box with us, and that there couldn't be disagreement of a severe kind among otherwise political allies, because unity becomes really important when politics becomes driven by the animosity towards the other side. We're constantly trying to figure out ways to signal to our allies that we're authentic. And what that means is that we suppress disagreement among our alliances and with our allies so that we don't start looking to our political friends as if we're kind of posers. And that is also, it seems to me, anti-democratic, right? Politics is messy, right? Like you say, hey, it's, you have to give. Otherwise, there's some objectionable things about the Salvation Army stance about all kinds of issues, but you got to give them credit where credit's due.
And that's what I kept saying to my friends. Think about it. I said, I hate to tell you, but were the Mormons down when the hurricane happened? No, it was the freaking Salvation Army that was there. I keep saying to people, look at the good too. Don't discount the good. And if you can look on the good, you build the relationship. That's how you build the trust. I used to do radio on conservative stations, and I still do radio every Friday morning on a Rush Limbaugh, you know, whatever, Tucker Carlson, Sean Hannity, whatever that is, station. And I'm their token liberal every Friday morning for 20 years. They think I'm on every day. I'm only on for 20 minutes for a whole week, you know? It's very interesting to me because this Christmas, I got a card from one of the listeners on this conservative station. I had told the story about how I'd been sort of harassed at a Dunkin' Donuts by a group of kind of big thugs, you know, about my politics. And so I had told this story. I know this guy, he's a defense contractor. I know what he does for a living, and I know we don't agree politically. He sent me a Dunkin' Donuts gift card and apologized for them. I was like over the moon. I was so happy because despite the fact that we disagree, there was some part of me that he kind of said was okay. He was able to get through the nuance because I put myself on that conservative station. I take the grief. I take the harassment. But I also not only dish back my response, but I also find the places where they can celebrate my new grandchild born in Shanghai. And I find places where we can be happy together, not just antagonistic together.
Maintaining, when it's possible, proper democratic relations, even with your foes politically. You know, you might say, look, I still think their politics are bananas. I mean, you might still emerge from interactions still disagreeing. But even people whose politics you think are bananas can still teach you, even if what they teach you is the ways in which they misunderstand your views, right? So you can still learn from your opponents, even if you think they are off the reservation, if they are just mistaken through and through, they're beyond the pale. Talking to them still can bring you the benefit of saying, well, Here's how they misunderstand or misrepresent my position. So let me now insulate against that. It's as if the country has gotten so deep into its partisanship that we've forgotten something very fundamental about democracy. It runs on disagreement. Democracy is about political disagreement. It's the thesis. It's the proposal that politically equal citizens can achieve a relatively decent, stable, and just society, despite the fact that they disagree about politics. And the idea that we can do democracy by just shutting out those with whom we disagree, shutting them down, the idea that the only legitimate democratic rule would ultimately be one-party rule, which I think is something that a lot of Washington politicians, especially among the Republicans, seem really attracted to these days. It's just fundamentally anti-democratic. If you want democracy, you need political opposition. If you want democracy to run well, you need to maintain, when you can, healthy democratic relations with your opponents.
My dad wrote in my high school yearbook, okay? I graduated in 1971. And in my high school yearbook, my father, who was a teacher, wrote, "Remember, no one has cornered the market on virtue." And that's because we would disagree, my father and myself, all the time. I mean, at one point, my father was having such a big fight with me. He actually broke a glass table because he put his fist down on the table. And I went, "Papa, you went too far." But we also loved each other. In a bizarre way, I am so grateful I came from a family where the extreme was what sort of defined us politically, but that we could figure out how to sort of navigate that and find a way what we could celebrate together. And that's why my goal, maybe even being on the radio, I mean, I've done Fox News, okay? I'm on this conservative station. I replaced Rush Limbaugh on five stations in the mid-2000s, okay? Because he left the station and everyone said, "Are you crazy?" And I said, "No, I'm not crazy. This is not the enemy. I'm not the enemy." And I think that's where I don't know how we do it. I want to sit down with the young AOC and talk to her about it. I've known Bernie Sanders since he was mayor of Burlington, Vermont. I mean, I remember when he first got to Congress, he used to be on my radio show in White River Junction, Vermont. And I asked him, did he caucus in the bathroom? Because he was like, you know, the only independent. Even Bernie, and Bernie will tell you, some of the people he has worked with are the most extreme on the other side because they learned to back into each other. And yeah, he wouldn't not embrace that support because the goal was ultimately to get it passed. Everyone looks at Bernie as this sort of isolating liberal, but yet he is what they call him, the amendment god. He can take other people's pieces of legislation and still figure out a way for him to craft a path.
Yeah, politics in a democracy, politics is dirty hands. That's what it is. And, you know, the price of ideological purity in a well-functioning democracy is inefficacy. You can't achieve anything if you're interested in being ideologically pure. You have to work with the other side. That's just what the game is.
I taught a lot of leadership classes, especially high school and college leadership classes. And I remember telling them that sometimes the hardest thing for you to realize is that maybe your name on something will be a detriment to it. Not what you're asking for, but your association with it. And I told a story about one of the biggest pieces of legislation ever written in my state was something that I wrote, but the Republican chairman carried. And no one knew that I wrote it. And he said to me, "Why are you willing to do this?" I said, "Because the success of the project is more important than people knowing it. And the part that you will love, Robert, is that for the first time in decades in the House, it's a long time ago, when it passed, my chairman got a standing ovation." And my chairman is up at the podium, and I'm in the back row, Robert. That's where my seat was. You know where how privileged I was not. And my chairman is looking at me, and I'm almost standing on my chair clapping because we both knew. And what we both knew wasn't that I had written it and he carried it, but that it passed. And that's also hard because in politics, so much of it is driven by ego and the idea that you need to be identified with the result. And I keep telling people, no, it's the result that needs to happen.
Unfortunately, it gets more and more difficult to make that kind of message politically viable when politics is now, it's a marketing thing. Yeah, every politician is a brand. The people running the campaigns are also selling us cars and toothpaste. that everything is about sort of maintaining your market visibility in roughly the same way that you sell other kinds of products. When politics has become that kind of marketing game, considerations like the one you were just raising, Arnie, about achieving things for the common good, regardless of whose name goes on it, all of that gets eroded or gets downplayed in a way that I think ultimately is bad for us, for all of us politically.
All right. So I'm going to ask you to write for the conversation again, because I'm going to call you back, because this is too important. We need to talk about this out loud. People need to hear this and people need to think about it. I really do try to figure out where the paths are for us to find some sort of consensus and that we need each other. And ultimately, that's what this is about. We need each other. And I see the pandemic, despite what Donald Trump did, which was so outrageous about the mask wearing and the social distancing and the anti-science, we're coming to Jesus on this because it is infecting us in ways that I think a lot of people are so shocked by. There's potential with the pandemic to actually heal. And I don't just mean the vaccine. I also think climate change could be a great divider, but it could be a great healer. Because when you realize what's happening with the hurricanes in Texas, or you realize what's happening with the weather extremes in places like Nebraska and Iowa, when you recognize the fires in California, that is an opportunity to heal, because it doesn't ask your party, it doesn't ask your wealth, it just destroys. And then we get destroyed together. So I am maybe crazy, but I see that as a possibility of finding common ground, because our vulnerabilities will bring us together. And that may be something that I would like to see we work on, as opposed to we see it as something to fear. I see it as an opportunity to heal.
I hope you're right.
I hope I'm right too. Robert Talese, he's a professor of philosophy at Vanderbilt University, my brother's alma mater, and the title of his piece, America's Political Divide, will be very hard to heal. Please join me again.
I will. Thank you.
All right. Ciao. This Bye-bye. Is the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We're going to go to a break and we will be right back. Stick around.
Insight Daily Radio.
From food to fashion, science to tech talk, or for just plain fun, we've got you covered. From the art of all things, here's Lasana Jeffries.
Here's some interesting facts about some of our favorite drinks. People who drink coffee are less likely to commit suicide than those who don't. 37% of U.S. coffee drinkers use milk and sugar. 21% drink it black. There are 1,000 different chemicals in a cup of coffee. 26 of them have been tested to see if they cause cancer in laboratory rats, and 13 of them do. In the 1820s, the temperance movement tried to ban coffee and nearly succeeded. Coffee beans aren't beans. They're fruit pits, making coffee the most consumed fruit in the United States. In a 12-year study, it was found that coffee does not, as was previously believed, cause high blood pressure. Been to a coffee klatsch lately? The term is from the German coffee klatsch, a combination of the words for coffee and gossip. 1 teaspoon of liquid nicotine, or half an ounce of pure caffeine, is considered a lethal dose for a 150-pound man. Africa's largest private sector employer is Coca-Cola. The world's largest consumer of sugar and vanilla, Coca-Cola. It costs the Coca-Cola company more to make the can than the soda. Once America's most popular soft drink, root beer now accounts for less than 4% of the national market. Diet Pepsi was originally called Patio Diet Cola. In 1900, the average American drank 12 sodas a year, and today that's 600. Coca-Cola was first marketed in 1885 as a remedy for hangovers and headaches. Root beer was an herbal tea before it was a soda. Its creator, Charles Hiers, added carbonated water to over 25 herbs, berries, and roots, and the rest is history. Thanks for listening. I'm Lisanna Jeffries.
Insight Daily Radio.
What's your choice? What's your choice? What's your choice? Tell me, who do you love? Am I the one that you're thinking of? You know you look so good.
Oh, it's really a crime
for just one girl,
yeah, to be so fine.
You've got all
Tell me, who do you love, girl? Make up your mind. Make up your mind. What's your choice? Tell me, who do you love? Am I the one that you're thinking of? You know Jim, he's sincere.
Oh, and Joe, he's fun.
Johnny's nice.
Yeah, but is he the one?
Then there's me, who's last but not least. So come on now, girl, and speak your piece. Speak your piece. What's your choice?
Ooh, tell me, who do you love?
What's your choice? You don't need to
know, and
one will do. So come on now, say it's me and you. Me and you. What's your choice?
Ooh, tell me, who do you love?
What's your choice?
Welcome back to part two of the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Again, a reminder, we are Zooming on Monday afternoon. I see this piece that was entitled, What Bernie Sanders Can Teach Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Cut deals, don't unnecessarily alienate your party, and get the most you can. I've been mining the Washington Monthly for a couple of months now, and I thought, you know, I want to interview this guy about this because there's a lot of truth to that. And a lot of my young liberal progressive friends don't necessarily understand that lesson. So I thought, let me grab Bill Scherr. He is an American pundit and political analyst. He is a contributing editor to Politico Magazine, the other article we may get to, and a contributor to Real Clear Politics. He also co-hosts, I got to be on the show, the DMZ, an online TV show with conservative pundit Matt Lewis. So let me welcome you to the program. Having been on conservative stations and having done Fox, and actually Sinclair News calls me all the time, I understand the DMZ. So let me welcome you to the program, Bill. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
All right. So let's talk a little bit about this piece you wrote, because AOC is truly the darling of the left. She's brilliant. She's articulate. She has some of the best questions that we've seen during those C-SPAN hearings. Mm-hmm. She has a lot of political savvy. There is absolutely no question about it. You begin your piece with what's happened this term, because despite that smarts, she didn't necessarily get the appointment that she wanted to the committee that she wanted, and committee appointments define your career. Let's start by your telling what happened to her and what she can learn from Bernie, because I think you're absolutely right.
You know, 6 weeks or so since the election, Bernie and AOC have done two notable and divergent things. AOC spent a lot of the immediate aftermath of the election trying to deflect blame that was being put upon her and other socialists and progressive populists for the reduced margins in the House, trying to argue that it was not defund the police and it was not Green New Deal and it was not Medicare for All, et cetera, et cetera. Bernie, you know, Bernie didn't abandon any of his positions, but in most recent weeks, he really latched on to this issue of direct payments. He wanted $1,200 payments per person. He said he wasn't going to allow the bill to go through the Senate until they were in there. He can't filibuster by himself, but under unanimous consent rules, he can delay things. So he threw that leverage around. AOC, after her media tour, tried to get on the House Energy and Commerce Committee, which would be a good platform to push Green New Deal. And there was a vote by essentially a committee of Democrats, and she lost it in a landslide. So that the House Democrats are basically saying, we don't want you to have this perch to push Green New Deal because we don't think Green New Deal is a good issue for us. We think you have hurt the party by pushing this. Bernie, meanwhile, and Bernie is, as you know, arguably as much as an outside antagonist to the party as she has been. He's not even officially a Democrat still. He gets his idea in the bill. He not only gets Democrats to rally around it. He gets some Republicans to rally around, including Josh Hawley in particular. And Mitch McConnell, who is obstructionist extraordinaire, makes the political calculation, it's not worth fighting Bernie on this. I don't want to go to the public and say, I'm stopping you from getting checks. I'm going to give you half a loaf because the centrists in the Senate don't want the price tag to go too high. So it's going to be 600, not 1200. Bernie doesn't blow up the whole negotiation. He says, I'll take it. I'm going to criticize it as not enough, but I'll take it. And lo and behold, this is one of the biggest bills of the year. And Bernie Sanders has shaped the outcome. Whereas AOC is now on the sidelines without a perch to push her ideas. It's a very crystallized example of how you can be on the left. You can take an idea that's not being discussed by the center of the system and push successfully if you pick your battles in a strategic way. Whereas if you get caught on things that have already been tainted, I mean, as much as you might like single payer or Green New Deal or defund the police, as a political reality, the moderates of the party are telling you, this did not work for us. We don't want to salvage these things. You could have cut bait and picked a new issue to push, as Bernie did. Instead, right. She got stuck on the old issues and she lost the seat that she won on the key committee.
So there's a couple of things I'm thinking about. I met Bernie right after he was mayor of Burlington. And the first time he won the mayor's race in Burlington, he won by like a handful, I think 12 votes. It was like ridiculous. And everyone was like, oh my God, we got a socialist. This is the big queen city. Oh my God. Well, guess what? He learned a lot being mayor of Burlington. He learned to work with the business community. He learned about what was good for business, was actually good for Burlington and good for people. And he learned to tailor and have a conversation so that the next time he ran for mayor, he won by a huge margin because it wasn't tainted to have that conversation. He brought that little bit of a piece of that mayor with him throughout his entire political career, when he was in Congress, when he was in the U.S. Senate, and frankly, when he ran for president. That took experience for him to understand that. AOC's experience wasn't there. I mean, she ran for Congress against an institution within the Democratic Party, and they hated her guts for that because she removed him. But, you know, I mean, in a lot of ways, she was a reminder to a lot of Democrats, maybe you should come home once in a while. And that was probably a good lesson for them. As I'm listening to you talking, I also want to say something, not in defense of AOC, maybe some people should have come to her defense. And here's what I'm talking about. Who does Joe Biden credit with winning? And I don't just mean the congressman from South Carolina. He refers to Black Lives Matter and Black women. Am I right?
Mm-hmm.
What do you think Black Lives Matter talks about? The police, healthcare, the job market. That's what they want. They don't want the moderate conservative agenda. They're BS about what's happened with the police, and we've ignored it. They are furious about the fact that they are sicker and less healthy and can't afford healthcare and the first ones that are expendable when it comes to healthcare. So ironically, they shouldn't push AOC so far out. Or maybe what AOC needs to figure out is, how does she bring in the women that delivered for Joe Biden? And he's constantly saying, thank you, thank you. And reminding those moderates and those corporate Democrats and those conservative Democrats that Black Lives Matter and those Black African-American women, this is what drove them to the polls, not the status quo, not waiting for some kind of expanded whatever on healthcare, but they understand the level of vulnerability because they've lived it. That's where I think part of what AOC needs to also figure out is where she can find common ground within Biden's base and remind Biden that what brought you to the table may not have been all us progressive lefties, but maybe some of those African-American women actually agree with us. And they need those policies if life is going to change for their families and for their states and for their communities, which explains in part why they got involved in politics. It was not about you, Joe. I hate to break it to you. You were not the invitation in. Some old white guy would not excite me. And she also did something that you also mentioned in your article, that she basically said anyone that doesn't support Medicare for all should be primary. excuse me, that's not your job any more than it's the DNC's job to tell her not to run against Chuck Schumer. If people want to run in a primary, they should. Primaries are important elections, maybe more important sometimes, but it's not for her to target any more than it is for the DNC to protect.
Two things I want to raise there. First, in regards to AOC and her strategy, I think she just has to decide what she wants. If she wants to run for president in 2024, be it against Joe Biden or Kamala Harris or what have you, I mean, that's a perfectly, as you say, primaries are legit things. You know, no one's precious. She's allowed to primary Biden or Harris if she chooses. There's a logic to being the outside agitator who's criticizing the system writ large if she's going to do that. If you're going to do that, don't expect to get the insider committee assignment. You choose your path. If you want to master the House, then learn from Bernie how to get amendments into bills that maybe you don't like every nook and cranny of. Right. If that's not your interest, then so be it and go be an outsider, but pick your path.
And also understand she comes in at the most incredible time. I mean, she comes in with Donald Trump as president. Ay, ay, ay. She comes in with the pandemic. Oh my God. I mean, there wasn't a lot of time to kind of learn that political skill set you have just because we were living in such extremes. And that's what the last 2 years has been defined by. I mean, if we thought it was extreme when he got elected, it just got more acrid and more extreme during the last 2 years. So to some extent, it may have hardened her as opposed to opened her. But at the same time, I mean, that's where Bernie has an advantage. In some ways, it's where Joe Biden has an advantage. We keep saying they've been around too long, and I wanted both of them to sort of get out of the way and be senior statesmen. But there is value in the knowledge.
Well, a lot of your younger modern socialists, progressive populist activists and politicians, they're very prone to taking any crisis and saying, this is proof we need this socialist thing. Coronavirus is proof we need Medicare for all. It's proof we need Green New Deal. It's George Floyd is proof we have to defund or abolish the police. I think the hard lesson of 2020 is that might seem like a real obvious point to you. It's not as obvious to the median American. The median American might agree police brutality is bad and climate change is bad and our healthcare system needs a whole lot of work. They may not be immediately jumping to your conclusion here. And your hashtag slogan can get distorted very readily by Republican attack ads. And we saw it happen in the races where Democrats lost their seats. I don't think AOC is very inclined to make those kind of recalibrations.
Was it in your article? I've read so many articles. But that most of the Republicans that defeated Democrats happened to be Republicans of color.
Yeah.
Happened to be women Republicans. Mm-hmm. So it's very interesting. The Republicans have figured out what their vehicle is. And their vehicle ain't white men.
We'll see if they've truly figured it out. Some people have figured it out.
If you look at those districts where they actually defeated a Democrat, technically on paper should have won or had a good chance of winning, it's very interesting because wherever they found them, they found diversity in a party that is all white men. That was when they were able to do the wedge. What's going to be really interesting for me is to see how those women and those African-American Republicans are going to operate in Congress. Mm-hmm. Because it's one thing to run and win. It's another thing to figure out how to function. Mm-hmm. The GOP right now, I don't know what they stand for. Mm-hmm. You know, with Trump gone, I don't know how much he is going to continue to influence, but I don't know what he stood for.
They have a lot to figure out.
They have a lot to figure out. They have a lot to figure out. It is going to be very interesting to me to see how AOC maneuvers. I think one of the people that I think who has come in is the congresswoman from California. Who am I talking about? Warren's protege from California.
Katie Porter.
Oh my God, I adore her. I want her to be, I don't know what. She can be the Pope as far as I'm concerned. Katie Porter is also interesting because I think she's very progressive, but she also knows how to sort of focus her niche and use that skill set and that scholarship so effectively that she hasn't necessarily diversified herself on a lot of things, but she has stood out where everyone is. Whoa. Mm-hmm. I look at the AOCs and I look at the Katie Porters, and they're both, I think, from similar camps, but they've taken very different approaches.
Mm-hmm. And some of the other congressmen who lost, I mean, near Katie Porter, Harley Ruda and Gil Cisneros, who are, I think, a bit more moderate than Porter was, they lost to Asian American women, districts with a good number of Asian Americans. And that, in and of itself, is not what automatically solves your problem.
Right.
I do think we have evidence that in certain Asian American communities, in certain Latino Hispanic communities, some of the more conservative messaging, the culture war messaging, was working on the Republicans' behalf and on the Democrats' behalf. And in the Democratic primary, to circle back to a point you were making earlier, I should caveat, you know, I'm not the voice of the Black community. That's not my lot in life to tell you what Black people think.
It's who white people are talking to each other.
Right. Don't take anything I say as gospel here. I'm just doing my best to interpret data that I have. But a lot of people assumed that to win the African-American vote in the Democratic primary, you should run to as far to the left as possible. Joe Biden proved that wrong. I mean, he won that primary in South Carolina. And South Carolina is not only a majority Black Democratic electorate, but it's also a very moderate electorate. I don't want to oversimplify. It's not like your average South Carolina African-American is a big fan of Simpson-Bowles deficit reduction. You know, it's not the kind of centrism we're talking about here. There's a pragmatic streak that there is a resistance to an outsider lefty just showing up and saying, I'm going to give you all these wonderful goodies.
Take a look at the Latino Hispanic community. I'm going to look at the African-American community. And I also think that there's a difference between the older version and the younger version. And I think what AOC is talking to is a group of younger Latinos and younger African-Americans who are saying, we have waited. They're the ones that go to jail, not the 60-year-olds. It's the 22-year-olds that go to jail. And they're saying, and for why? Why? Because we drove while Black.
Yeah.
Because we walked in the street while Black. Cops don't pick up older Black men and older Black women. They don't. They pick up younger Black men and younger Hispanics. You know that, and I know that. And then you have to start asking the question, why? So to some extent, the rise in student debt, some of the issues of healthcare, some of the issues of the police really are a young person's issue. Mm-hmm. And we have failed. Mm-hmm. We have failed them. And I think the AOCs and a lot of those young voters are saying, if not now, when? Mm-hmm. When do you address it? And I think their parents are a little more nuanced and worried because they've been around the block a lot. You
know, and that South Carolina electorate was an older electorate.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. It's going to be very interesting to see how the next 2 years shakes down. Now, we only have about 15 minutes left, so I want to touch on your other article.
Sure.
Oh, my God. So your other article is at Politico. It's at Politico's magazine, everyone. And you wrote, which 2024 candidates won 2020? A year in guide to where the 2024 hopefuls stand and what we should watch out for, especially in 2021. So like their behavior in 2021 is kind of like, okay, it's a Rorschach test. Where are they going and what are they doing? I don't know if I want to start with Joe and Kamala and Donald and Pence. They're the obvious. People both, I think, discount both Joe and Trump running again. Age is a function. 4 years is a long time for Donald. He's not in power and he's not the center of attention. You know, he may have his news network and he may have Parler and whatever, but he doesn't have the same power. Joe, however, will be somewhat the center of attention. He does have the power, but he doesn't have the personality. Okay? So I'm looking at those two and I'm thinking, nah. I know, I'm awful. So now that I'm saying, I want you to then talk about sort of the rest of the story, because I'm looking at Pence and Kamala and I'm thinking, Pence has a Biden problem. He kind of fits in with the wallpaper. So I'm just trying to figure out whether Pence can take the loyal soldier piece he did with Trump and whether that carries cachet with anyone but Pence's family.
Well, and just to preface this, I know some people really get triggered when you talk about 2024, 4 years out. I don't think this is just a silly pundit exercise. This is about where are these parties going to go? I mean, I think both parties are in flux ideologically. And so the jockeying that the wannabes are doing is all educated guesswork on what direction do I think this party is going in, and or what direction do I want to take this party in? And so you see people in both parties making different strategic calculations where they think the party is going to go, or where they think it should go. Trump and Pence hover over the party quite significantly, as do Biden and Kamala. And it's possible that Trump doesn't run because he might, as much as he probably could run and could win the nomination, he might conclude, if it's going to be another loss, another humiliation that I can't blame on vote rigging, maybe I don't want to put myself through that. So if he bows out, and you might say Pence is just kind of bleh, you know, he doesn't get anyone excited. Look at the track record of vice presidents that run in presidential primaries.
Win.
They almost always win. The only exception is Quayle. Quayle was uniquely unpopular and had the added problem of running against the president's son.
Right. Right.
And it's not just a question of...
Let me stop you there, because let me just remind you, wasn't one of the reasons why they picked Dan Quayle because he was easy on the eyes?
Yeah, he was the next generation candidate.
Woo! There you go. My middle fingers are up in stereo, everyone. So, I mean, I'm just telling you, easy on the eyes should tell you that that's a problem right there. Okay.
But if Pence is to run and win, his essential argument is, one, I'm a Trump loyalist, but I'm also a figure of stability. I'm Trump without the insanity. And if the party is going to remain a Trumpist party, Pence is in a very good position to continue that mode, that ideological calibration, however you want to, it's a hard thing to define precisely.
Right. But let me just ask a question. If he's Trump without the insanity, what's attractive about Trump to his base is the insanity. I mean, I hate to break it to you. If it was just whatever Trump is, without the insanity, there is no Trump. Without the lies, there is no Trump. Without the pulling you by your you-know-what, but what he just did with the COVID relief bill, that's Trump, okay? So if Pence is Trump without the insanity, then there's nothing there.
I think what he could potentially replicate, he can't replicate Trump, soup to nuts. He can replicate Trump's waging of culture war, which Pence is quite comfortable doing. If that's the glue that holds the party together, as much as they like tax cuts and they like certain policies here and there, if what they really like most is fighting liberals, fighting socialists, fighting the media, fighting secular progressivism, Pence can do that. And if he can do that in a way that doesn't bleed as much out of the college-educated suburbs, that's a potentially winning case. Now, maybe that Pence's social conservatism is too much for some in the suburbs, so I'm not saying it's a slam dunk, but that's the theory. If it's not going to be him, you have a handful of senators who are kind of, sort of Trump juniors, Rubio Cruz, Hawley, I'm sure I'm forgetting a guy off the top of my head, Tom Cotton. They're all trying to sound like Trump, act like Trump, but they never can do it quite as well. Rubio's even said flat out, if Trump runs, he's the nominee. Hawley said, if Trump runs, I'm going to support him. These folks won't even go as far as to even think about challenging him. They're just hoping he doesn't run, and then they can take up his mantle. I think they'd have a hard time going up against Pence in that situation. I mean, it's possible Pence might get scuffed for not fighting for Trump at the Electoral College count. But being a senator is just not a great perch. Very few sitting senators make it to the presidency. The few that have, a couple Democrats, JFK, Barack Obama, they're young, fresh. They weren't bogged down in the Washington muck. Mm-hmm. There's been no sitting Republican senator that's become president since Warren Harding 100 years ago. It's just not a great place to stretch your legs.
Governors are a good place. And the reason governors are a good place is that they've been the CEO, okay? But they haven't been the CEO in Washington. Mm-hmm. They don't have the baggage of being inside the Beltway. So they can sort of take their state. And you mentioned Governor Abbott. We cover Houston. I'm very familiar. And I think Governor Abbott has a lot of ambition. He's very conservative, but he's very smart. He has a huge war chest. And Texas is our future. I mean, it is, we kept thinking it was going to flip this year. It did not, because Republicans are very good at understanding Texas. Let's look at the non-senators. Let's look at the governors, because you've got Florida, you've got Texas. You've got a couple of interesting Republican governors on both sides, more moderate and also more conservative.
Kristi Noem of South Dakota, Ron DeSantis, Florida, Greg Abbott, Texas. Those are the three Republican governors that I think are displaying the most ambition right now. DeSantis and Noem have been particularly provocative on coronavirus, been very Trumpist, very defiant. Florida, their numbers aren't so bad. They're not great and they're surging right now. They're more middle of the pack. So he can kind of say, well, I'm not as bad as this state or that state. You guys thought I was going to ruin the whole state and it's not so bad. Kristi Noem is having a hell of a surge, although it's starting to fade right now. And maybe in the net of it, it will even out over time. She'll have to potentially answer those questions, down the line, whether she handled things appropriately. And Greg Abbott, interestingly, some conservatives are mad at him because he's been kind of zigzagged on mask mandate. He was against it, then he was for it. He's had a bunch of lawsuits against him from conservatives.
He zigzagged on voting. He extended early voting by a week by executive order. His own party chairman basically wanted him out because of it.
Right.
But his party chairman's crazy in Texas. We only have 3 minutes left. We haven't even talked about any of the Democrats. Throw out, other than Kamala, who do you think is a real potential for running in 2024? And Kamala has the inside track, so we know.
Yes,
that.
I mean, if it's not Biden, Kamala is slotted. I think AOC would likely run to kind of keep up that Bernie socialist mantle. Whether she has a good shot winning or not is, I think, irrelevant to her. Then those who were most ambitious are Gavin Newsom and Andrew Cuomo, and they've had a bit of a rocky year, you know, pandemic-wise. They started off hot, and now it's gotten kind of muddled. They're not easy candidates. Now, if it's not Biden, the question mark on Kamala is, can she win the Rust Belt? Is she positioned to do that? I'm sure she's going to spend a lot of time in Wisconsin and Michigan and Pennsylvania and Ohio on the factory floor, in the bowling alleys.
Cleaning that water in Detroit.
Yeah, right, that's right. But if she is not clicking there, then maybe a Cuomo or Newsom saying, look, I'm a better bet. Now, neither one of them are in the Midwest either, mind you. And maybe a Governor Beshear in Kentucky or Governor Cooper in North Carolina start crop. I didn't mention them in this particular article because they haven't made those kind of moves. But there's not that many Midwesters. You know, Gretchen Whitmer, of course, might come up if her numbers stay up. There's only a small amount of heartland Democrats who are governors or senators to choose from and who want the job. You'd have to see some action on their part to maneuver, to be in position for it if Kamala's not in a group.
Bill, in 1 minute, tell them who your long shot is. I couldn't stop laughing when I got to the long shot. And I'm like, of course. But tell my audience who your long shot is.
Mike Lindell, MyPillow CEO. The Republicans, they like the celebrity businessman. He is the celebrity businessman du jour. He's been doing a lot of political activity. He's been actually attacking Fox lately. He made a big name of spending money on Fox TV ads. Tucker Carlson's biggest sponsor is MyPillow. And Tucker might run himself, mind you. Of all the people I've mentioned, he's been the most in the stop the steal space.
Yeah.
So he's going to try to outflank Pence on who is the biggest Trump loyalist. Right. Lindell is actually the best position for that right now.
So let me just say something about our MyPillow and the CEO. When Donald Trump started running, I reminded my national audience that he had been in our living room for years because of The Apprentice, okay? Mm-hmm. So he didn't need to be explained. Guess what? MyPillow doesn't need to be explained either. He's been in my bedroom and my living room. So on that note, Bill Scherr is an American pundit and political analyst. He's a contributing editor to Politico's magazine on Real Clear Politics and co-host, you better get me on, the DMZ, an online TV show with a conservative pundit, Matt Lewis. Thank you so much for joining us and have a wonderful new year.
You too. Take care.
Okay, ciao. All right, everyone. This is the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arnison, the producer Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We will schmooze tomorrow. Ciao. You better-